What's up, everyone? Welcome to another episode of Full Stack Whatever. I am your host, Michael Omans, and today I'm talking with Brian Levin and Ryan Nystrom. Brian and Ryan are co-founders of Campsite, and as a disclaimer, I am an angel investor in Campsite. We talked about the lessons they have learned from starting the company, but also their past lessons and experiences that informed the way that they build Campsite. I love this conversation as we talk about a lot of topics that continuously roam around in my mind as I think about how to support my teams in the best way possible. Please enjoy episode 43, Surrounded by People Doing Interesting Work.
Welcome to the show, Brian and Ryan.
Thanks, man.
Thanks. Yeah.
To everyone listening, Brian and Ryan are the co-founders of Campsite, not Campfire, which I always have in the back of my head because I woke up in the base camp days or grew up in the base camp days, not woke up, which is a...
I woke up and this piece of software was just in my eyes. And I knew from that day forward I was going to be a designer.
I woke up and 37 signals was all over the place. Kind of like that Matrix awakening moment, you know, but then it's way less impressive and with a lot of baby yellow like color behind a form field when you click on it and you want to edit it. Good old Ajax days.
Yeah.
Well, it's good that we have a serious intro going. It's awesome. I'm going to butcher it, but then I would love for you to like kind of correct it. It's like Campsite is a tool that kind of originally was, I think, envisioned as something for designers to communicate around the work that they were doing and slowly is becoming much more of like a cross-functional tool where like designers and their partners can talk about the work. And it harkens back a little bit to the Facebook Pixel Cloudy days, but it's gone much further beyond that, even I think past beta version number one or something, because that was also a very rudimentary internal hacky tool. It's been, I think, almost a year
over a year. Can you believe that?
And it's also been over a year that Brian was the first guest on this podcast.
Yeah.
So I think you are the first returning guest.
I remember when we recorded, it was before I'd raised money for Campsite. And I remember listening to the episode because it came out after I'd raised money.
Oh, yeah.
So we recorded it like before all this context, before I'd like really committed to doing the thing. I don't even know if I'd quit GitHub at the time we recorded. And then when it came out, I quit GitHub, raised money. I think maybe even started building a team. I don't know if Ryan and I had, actually, we'd probably started talking at that point, Ryan. I think we started kind of talking about it in October 2022.
Yeah, late last year.
So anyways, our first recording together, Michael, I went back and listened to it.
Yeah, I'm not sure what it's going to be like. We'll figure it out. I might work on it or not. And then here we are a year later. It's like, nope, we got a team, a company, raise money, got customers. It's going. We're figuring it out.
It's been quite a long way.
Yeah, the specificity of this is the, we recorded on November 11th. And I don't think it went live until January 13th, which just shows you that in the holiday season, you can move so fast. I mean, a lot of people say, hey, holiday season and things slow down. That doesn't really have
to.
It only took
you 2 months to get the podcast out. Like you are
yeah,
just,
that's
you are
actually what I heard.
Years to get even the like to get over myself to like actually do this thing because I was like so self-conscious about it. What I wanted is I wanted to have 4 episodes in the can so that when I knew that I was going to launch it, you know, the thing about launches is like the work with a launch starts the moment it goes live. Everyone else is like, oh, we're all going to like crunch until this deadline. But the reality is the thing goes live. Then the actual work starts. And I knew that kind of like my expectation was that same thing happens with the podcast, which is, okay, it's live now. Well, there's something with the website that's wrong, or I want to update this, or hey, here's the Instagram account, or I want to make these little clip things, which I've absolutely been horrendous at keeping, you know, the LinkedIn account up to date, the Threads account up to date, the Instagram account up to date. I've just been creating the content. The marketing my content is something that I'm horrific at, but like the creation is going well. And so I needed the 4 episodes to like feel confident enough that if, you know, I didn't have the time, because I also didn't know how it was going to fit into my life, you know, because like work takes up a lot of time. You want to not have this affect you as much as possible. And so just having 4 was a nice buffer to make sure that there was enough time to do more recordings, not get anxiety around it. And so you were the first one. I think the second one and the third one came each week after. And then I sat on 4 episodes for a month and I almost didn't start it. And I was like, fuck, do I really want to do this? The website wasn't good enough.
Do I really want to put podcaster on my bio?
It was actually like, I think the thing that really, it was like this typical getting in your own way. People around the internet have probably said and heard this enough times where like you are your own worst client. And so when you do the thing, but you're also like the client that requests the thing, you're not going to write your own brief or something, you know? And so eventually I had to kind of pull myself out of that. I wrote like a small note. I think it was like a half page about, this is what the website needs to be. These are the things that are going to happen when it goes live. And as soon as I had that hit list, I was like, okay, I'm just going to bang these out like towards
That's the, actually like, really a smart strategy, Michael. Like writing yourself a brief. I don't know. I've never
I mean, that's like the only way that I can do it, because otherwise you ship it and then you look at it and you're like, well, this is not good enough. And so I was fucking around with the website for like 3 weeks where I should have just been cutting episodes. The original episode was supposed to go live, I think, on the 6th or something. It wasn't done. And I was like, you know, going back, like it was my first week back at work. Like I had just like no time for it. And then I think it went live on the 13th, the 11th or the 13th. And they go live at 4 a.m. Pacific. It wasn't cut until 11:30 p.m. Oh, and then the second one wasn't cut until 1:30 p.m. And the third one wasn't cut until 1:30 p.m. either. Uh-huh. Which or AM. And so it just like shows you like how good I am at time management.
You're great.
Anyway.
The all the parallels to like working at a startup, running a startup, I mean, even just like product development in general. I mean, they'll like, just ship it, do it live. You're in your own head till somebody uses it and says it's good. All the things you were like listing off, I'm like, yeah, I'm not like running a podcast, but I'm like, we're literally in the thick of the like building stuff. Is anybody gonna like this? I want this. Wait, but I want it like that. And it's like, you just gotta ship it. The only thing that matters is like, good enough, get it out the door. And then I'm sure you got those like 4 episodes out and you were just like, all right, ball's rolling. Like, now I know what to do.
Yeah. I think that's a double-edged sword of building tools that you yourself use. On one side, it is so much fun because you have such direct influence and agency over like literally crafting the exact thing that you want to have. But quite often that comes at the expense of over crafting it if you have, I don't know, these quirks or this high bar for yourself. And it can lead to long periods of time where like those assumptions are unvalidated with people who aren't you or people who aren't on your team. It's like finding that balance stuff. I would still take the trade-off any day, though. I love working on things that I get to use.
Same.
Yeah.
Yeah, like I think
anything else?
As we're digging into this topic a little bit, what I think of is when it's a side project, it's really, for me at least, it's really hard to get out of the primary stream of work, right? And so when you have like your daytime primary job, basically, then it's like, I'm going to do the design of it. And then I maybe write some code on it, but I'm also talking to customers and I'm also, you know, trying to figure out the pricing, do XYZ, because you allocate yourself effectively 40, 60, whatever hours, like 80 hours a week, because you're focusing on kind of kicking this thing off. I think for me, at least when this is the secondary priority, it's like the thing that I care about the most is the purity of the product, which is effectively, it sounds like it's cocaine. It's not. it really,
podcast.
but it's this thing of, okay, as long as the content is good, like fundamentally, it's fine. The marketing around it, or, you know, reaching out to people, or like trying to like get a sense of, you know, like a proactive feedback loop where I ask, hey, what works, what doesn't work, blah, blah, blah. None of that really happens. Like, it's really hard, like for me at least, when it's a side project, to do the full spectrum approach to it all, basically. And maybe like one of the things that was like an original idea is like, well, I don't want to get stuck on the branding. I don't want to get stuck on the design right now. So I'll evolve it throughout the year. And then when I got to like episode 12, I was like, ooh, 12 is like like a season or like a series or something. I should do something with that. Like I should try and make a cut somehow. And so, but it wasn't until episode 37 that I actually retroactively rebranded episode 13 to 24 and then like 25 to like 36, basically. And so slowly you can see kind of the covers change now and the gradients are changing and like the type is changing. And now it's fun in retrospect because there's no pressure on it. And this was like a Sunday afternoon project. But I did all of that before I actually looked at, oh, how can I plug this better on and reach more people on social media, you know? So it really shows where my priorities lie and how important this is in that regard.
I mean, it just resonates so much. I don't know. I struggle with, I love the building. I love the shipping. I love the one announcement. But when you have to do like, okay, I did the tweet, but now I have to like post it on LinkedIn or Threads. I'm like, ah, fuck it. I don't have time for that.
Yeah.
I'm really bad at the marketing and like the rigor of having a consistent message on every platform where people might encounter your thing. I'm even talking just about like product and campsite stuff. Like we have a LinkedIn page, but I don't post on the LinkedIn page. Probably should, but this is just my weak spot is the marketing of the thing.
Your mailing list is pretty good.
Yeah, I've sent emails.
I like those. But yeah, let's not talk about the podcast, actually. We're not here about that. We're here about Campsite. And we're here also, I think, what I think is also important, and this is like the core of the podcast, is it's not about Campsite necessarily. It's about how you two eventually started building Campsite and the experiences you've had. And, you know, normally we go back into a full career and we talk about, you know, 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, 20 years, however, we kind of get to talk about a year-ish. And I think the starting point of you, Brian, saying the perspective that I had when I was talking to you in the first episode and when that thing got published, in the meantime, you had raised money, this thing was ready to go, you had quit your job. There have been 11 months since. My guess is that each of those months probably has had as much flux as that first one. So what's been like the biggest lessons of the year?
Biggest lessons of the year. Don't start a startup. but if you're going to start one, start it with your pals who are really good at building stuff.
Yeah,
you go first, Ryan. What's been the biggest thing for you in the last year?
I think we knew this going in. You know, if you follow startup people on Twitter, you read Hacker News, everybody talks about failure. They talk about like, you got to try 10 different things. 9 are going to fail. 1 might work. That is true. What I think is left out of that is that like, it's hard to fail over and over again. And I'm not talking about fail and that it's like catastrophic failure. It's like you have an idea, you have some signal, you have feedback from customers, customer asks, whatever. You go, you build it, you pursue it, you ship it, you're excited about it, you're proud about it. And then it's kind of like, meh. And you know, you kind of have to have some kind of iron will to be able to ride. It is a roller coaster. Like you're like, yes, we're excited, you ship. And it's like, ah, didn't totally like the mark. And then you go back down, you got to do it again. And you know, it's one of those things that's like, you know it going into it. I think the learning is like, you got to really get disciplined about that function and get used to that cycle. It's not like I would say people don't start a startup, but it's like, you really got to think through the like, you're going to make wrong moves over and over again. But that actually is the process. Like it is like, basically process of elimination. Like you've got a bunch of really interesting ideas. And the way you validate them is by like trying a whole bunch of things and not throwing away the work that you've done, but learning from it, taking the pieces that did work, that were novel, that were interesting, that are reusable, and then twisting that into the next thing. So I don't know if that's necessarily a learning, but you know, I think we got excited. We like started building. We're like, yeah, we're shipping stuff. Like, this is awesome. And then a year later, it's like, whew, yeah, you really got to go through those cycles, yeah, man. Yeah. Like, you really got to ride them.
I think my perspective on whether more people should start startups has changed over the last few years.
No, you were big on that.
I was like, everybody should start a startup. Everyone should, well, especially designers. I was like, every designer should feel what it's like to have to run a business, make the business work. Understand all of the priorities that go into making the business work, which are quite often opposite the priorities of like your typical designer who might really care about like aesthetics or visual polish. And like, put yourself in the shoes of a small business owner who's got a lot of shit to get done, customers asking for things. Oh, and by the way, you're not profitable and you have fundraising to think about or just like finances in general to think about. And then, yeah, I go through this roller coaster of not everything is going to work. You don't get to fall back on an existing brand. You don't get to fall back on an existing customer base. If you fail, you don't switch teams. You go out of business, like the stakes are a little bit higher. And so I don't know. I don't know if most people actually should do that. I think more people like should start and pursue side projects that they maintain for long periods of time. Try that first. But I think the startup is, I don't know. Maybe it sounds too much like I'm making myself like the hero or like the warrior's journey. Like we're so tough. Here, like
just,
tapping just on
sounds like you had a great year. That's what I'm hearing.
No, but I'm saying like there's a real emotional roller coaster you're going to submit yourself to for a long period of time.
Yeah, long time. Like we're a year in and I'm like, we're like, in my opinion, I'm like, we're halfway through starting the beginning of the hockey stick curve. Mm-hmm. Like we're halfway through.
Yeah.
And you have to persevere. Yeah. 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 I mean, it reminds me of like one of the qualities when we were running the interview program at Facebook, like one of the traits that we would always look for in people is perseverance, or I would just call it like grit. And mm-hmm. I think that that's like the trait that I would recommend if you're going to start a startup. Hell, if you're going to work at a startup and you're going to like see it through to some sort of outcome, really internalize what level of grit do you have? And that it's also like not a bad thing if you're like, yeah, I don't think I have that much. That's fine. Mm-hmm. Just like don't go into it because
just
like
don't do this.
Yeah, just don't do it. Thankfully, I actually think like Brian and I are to toot our own horns. Like that is like a superpower of ours. We like trying shit. We like building stuff. We like shipping stuff. We like learning things. Mm-hmm. And we won't get too beat up when something isn't an overnight success. We'll just be like, yeah, well, that means we get to learn and try to do other stuff. Great. That's awesome. I'm sure when, if we're mega successful, we're going to be like looking back and be like, ah, remember when we built like a new product like every other week? Uh-huh, like yeah. That was really fun. Now we just got to like maintain this big thing that like can't break.
Yeah. That's the funny thing is like you talk to anyone who's running a startup at any stage and actually the problems don't go away. They just become new problems yeah. with more stakes and more people invested in the outcome of that problem. It's yeah. like, oh, our lives are going to be so much easier when we hit a million ARR. Oh, our lives are going to be so much easier when we raise the next round. It's, nope, it's never true. It's just like that milestone marks, even to your point, Michael, like the moment that you think is the moment of success is actually the beginning of the work to reach the next moment. And it just goes and goes. Which reflecting on what I've picked up a lot on this year is it's so important to have an emotionally stable partner in this. You know, there's a lot of advice online about whether you need a co-founder or not. And I started Campsite alone and did it alone for, I don't know, 5 or 6 months. The like before and after of Ryan joining and having a co-founder versus not is just this night and day experience of, I don't know, having this pressure valve to vent, to complain, to worry, to self-doubt. But the most important part of that relationship, in my opinion, is that the other person is emotionally stable enough to receive your venting, to receive your complaints, to receive your uncertainty, and not have that snowball into their uncertainty or their self-doubt. They can be this wall that receives and provides the outlet for someone else. And so that's become a really important thing for me this year. And I think we're pretty good at it, Brian, of like hopefully not stressing the other person out too much when one of us wants to complain or one of us is having a worse week than the other. For the most part, I think we're pretty good.
We somehow are like on opposite cycles because this week I had just like cold, kid was sick, like all this like crap was going on. I was just like, ugh, like sour. And Brian's like, I'm good. You okay, buddy? Just like checking in. I'm like, God. I mean, to your point, like I was reading some founder blog posts this week and one of them was by a solo founder. And I remember like walking away from reading that and I was just like, yeah, I have no idea how I would do this like by myself. It's already hard, like being totally remote. Like it can feel isolating at times, but like to have a co-founder and then like it's like a great team that like has each other's backs. But if you were a solo founder, I think, I mean, a solo founder remote, I think would be probably the most like isolating, lonely thing.
So brutal. Yeah, no thanks. Pass. I mean,
kudos to anybody that's doing it successfully because that just sounds, for me, that sounds extremely hard. But yeah, if anybody's crazy enough to do a startup, I would definitely recommend having a co-founder. If anything, just to like check your ideas, check your priorities, check your thinking, etc. Because yeah, that's the other thing is like I'll go down rabbit holes of my own thoughts and ideas that, and then I'll come to Brian and just be like, listen to this like crazy thing, and just be like, what? are you talking about? And we'll talk about it for a second. It's like, oh yeah, duh, that's nonsense. But if I was alone, I'd be totally unchecked and I'd be like, all right, this is our new 4-week roadmap. And then we'd waste enormous amounts of time.
Well, I think that's the important thing too, is that it's not just getting advice from somebody. It's getting advice from somebody with a shit ton of skin in the game where your suggestions directly influence what they're going to be spending their time on for the next N weeks of their life.
So we created some doors. We can decide in true game show style if we want to walk into them. One of the things that we started on, which I always think not enough people have a sense of, is you were talking about the importance of working through the problem, and partially like one of the topics that came out of that was grit. I think we can go into that a little bit. But one of the other ones, it really reminded me of, you know, a lot of people ask me, hey, when you angel invest, what do you look at? And one of the lower ranked things, which people always think is the highest ranked thing, is the idea. You know, the number one thing, I think, as a founder, but generally as someone who builds things, who designs things, I think designers are taught this because we call it killing your darlings. I think engineers can see it. Engineers have grown up with tools that allow you to just completely abandon branches. And so in a way, implicitly, they've learned it. I think that product managers have not learned this at all yet, where they will just go and go deeper on something when they're wrong and their partners can't even get them out of it a lot of the time. The number one thing that doesn't matter in my mind is the idea. Everything is about execution. You know, the example right now, there are various things in the market right now when it comes to AI. You know, Meta has some stuff, Amazon has some stuff, OpenAI, Microsoft have some stuff. There's only one that we're really talking about because one actually has like some kind of consumer product market fit. Does that mean that OpenAI is going to win? I don't know. But they're executing at this pace now that actually makes them relevant. And if they keep on executing at this pace, they keep on staying relevant. Are their IDs notably different? Probably not. And I think that those things are like a really interesting part, right? Because what then comes from that angle, like if you already know and agree that your idea is not the most important part, it's actually how you decompose the idea and deconstruct it into things that you can work on. Well, then when that one thing that you work on is trash, you just go work on another angle. Or when you know that nothing is absolutely correct or absolutely perfect and you believe there's always a kind of room for error, then you can, in my mind, always be curious and say, okay, so where's the misstep? In this logic tree, maybe 4 out of 5 things are actually correct, but what's the one thing that doesn't make it work? And how can we identify that thing? So ideas as not the priority is one door. Grit was the second door. I think that the third thing, and I really appreciate the way that you both already dug into this, is, and it's the number one reason why I wanted to start Full Stack Whatever, is the public narrative on something versus what is happening behind closed doors couldn't be more different. And oftentimes, you know, it's kind of explained away as, well, you know, the media doesn't know, blah, blah, blah. But, you know, a lot of founders and like book writers and influencers, they just have like their public facade. And that's like as much of a product as they're keeping up. And I think already hearing you both digging into this with a sense of candor and transparency already makes me very excited for the rest of this episode. And then definitely would want to dig more into the how someone can check you, or like how, like what that partnership really looks like. Because I do think in a way that is like a co-founder thing, but it's also like your first couple of hires kind of thing, right? It's not just the one person that when you hire them, everything is solved. It's not even the first 10 people. It's probably like the first like 50 people that are going to matter to truly set the tone for the rest of the company's lifetime. So yeah.
Oh, so many doors.
I don't know how to choose. You're ranting those all off and I'm like, I could talk for an hour on all of them.
I can choose. I feel like
CEO chooses.
The the product thing is really interesting, because I feel like, and maybe more interesting to people listening if they're into the product stuff, is like killing your darlings, like this very violent metaphors of unshipping things. Ryan has this saying, which I think is always a little bit with a wink, is that he's a product sociopath. There is zero emotional attachment to a feature or the code. It's a good thing, but I think it has some interesting downsides. So the good thing is that when something's not working, you don't try and force it. You just move on or try something else, or you unship the thing. I think we're pretty good about trying things, didn't work, unship it, delete the code, or salvage the bits of it that were interesting and move on to the next. And I think that keeps us moving really fast. It doesn't allow you to linger on bad ideas for too long. I think the opposite side of that is, first, how do you teach that to other people who don't have the same sociopathy? Is that the pronunciation of that? The same like degree of cold-hearted product mindset? Because I think for a lot of other people, especially ICs on the team, is like, they might care more about the thing that they wrote or the thing that they worked on. You see this a lot in big companies where a team will get shut down or a product will get canceled and people will quit their job. Like they were so attached to that thing that they were working on and not attached to the company. So I think that's one area we could talk about is like, how do you bring people along for the ride or like teach that? And then the second is, I think there's probably a happy medium between being too cold-blooded with killing products versus knowing what's the right amount of love and investment for something to actually become good.
I really like that first part, and it reminds me a lot of, so in interviews on design at least, but I know that there's like versions of this for Inge as well, is like you like to do the problem solving exercise, the whiteboarding exercise. And to me, the corollary is it's never about the solution in that exercise. It's always about how you get to that solution, right? And you can go completely off the reservation and come up with something that is maybe a terrible idea. But if you talk me through that in 45 minutes or an hour and you say how terrible that is and why that's not going to work and eventually kind of say, oh, this is not the direction that we're going to go in. Let's like try this other thing and then just not finish that second angle. You already showed me that you have critical thinking, but you at least wanted to play it out. It's a really weird angle to an interview. I've never had it happen, but I would totally be game for one of those, right? What I think is like early, especially early in your career, is like the thing that keeps you going is the pride around the work that you do, right? That's how you can measure your personal kind of impact, especially in a world, at least for broadly the generation that the three of us grew up in. There was definitely this Gen X effect, boomer effect on us. And we found our value through creating some things. I think that once you get one or two hits or things that work, you start realizing that the dopamine hit is cool, but it's only a means to an end. And I think that once you pass that threshold, it becomes much easier to realize that, yes, you're building this product or this feature, but actually what you're doing is you are proliferating the business. You are pushing the business forward. So, you know, putting it on OG Instagram terms, it was like Instagram kind of had this extremely lucky moment of all of these features live on other platforms and we still have to build them. So like very early, it was like, well, Twitter had a couple of things. Facebook had a couple of things. We have to kind of get to parity with those anyway. And when you're in that world, then you kind of get a lot of those wins for free in a way, right? Because you kind of know what they need to be. I mean, there's a whole, and maybe one day I'll get Chris Wheeldryer on here, who was like our first design manager. There's this whole like photos of you photo tagging debacle that took us like 3 months to build, primarily because we didn't want to call it tagging at the time. But like if we would have just called it tagging, we would have probably built it in like a month or less, basically, right? And so you can copy a lot of those things and that's where you get the early wins under your belt. But really, like at a certain point, realizing, and this is why I like to tell people, don't start your career at a startup, start it like somewhere else where you're kind of a little bit insulated and you have the systems to help you get to these wins. Like when you get a couple of wins and you realize, oh, well, this thing was cool, but it didn't work, but it was important for the business that we made it. Or this other thing was like very uncool. And you realize, and this is what I get drawn to a lot nowadays, the uncool stuff that is so important to a business. It really shows you like the public narrative, you know, what the tech industry thinks is cool, what Product Hunt thinks is cool, what is on TechCrunch, you know, versus, oh, actually, did you know that secretly over here, this company is just printing money because they found some, you know, middleman piece of white label software, you know?
Yeah. I've found that the coolness of the thing that you work on tracks to the coolness of the person. So this makes a lot of sense, Michael. Like over your career, you just work on less and less cool things.
Thanks, Brian.
I don't know if that joke went
brutal.
And that was the episode, everyone. Alrighty, thanks a lot for coming.
That was fun. No, I agree with you, Michael.
I mean, I completely I completely agree too. I mean, it is hard. I don't know if I would totally agree that everybody should start off with, I mean, we're all ex-Facebook people. I loved my like 5 years there that like, I felt like I was like trained to think about impact with the same sort of mindset. It's like cool, flashy, gets press, gets interviews, gets tweets. Like that's like a nice high. It's not necessarily impact.
Yes.
Like, impact is usually, I mean, we're working at like a big place like Facebook. It was money, time spent, likes, impressions, like these like core vital things that are like super important to the business. And I mean, I just remember before I joined Facebook, there were these people that were like the famous people that were working at Facebook and Instagram because they were all over Twitter or being interviewed or whatever. And then you come onto the inside and yeah, like, yeah, they're still important people. But then you'd meet these like insanely influential, impactful people that you never hear of on the outside because they're the ones that are like heads down, laser focused on impact, and they deliver, and assuming they're like rightfully rewarded for that delivery. And yeah, I do call myself like a product sociopath a lot. And I think that comes from the fact that like the only product that I feel like I really care about is the one that wins. And when I say wins, it's like that users love, that users come back to, it brings value to the business, it brings value to our users or to their businesses. That's the thing I'm like desperately searching for. I just want to find the thing that like somebody uses and they're just like, oh my God, like, thank you. This changes my life. This changes the way I run my team. This changes the way our business operates. It, you know, maybe it's quantifiable, maybe it's not. Maybe they're just like, thank you. I love this. I'm going to use this every single day. Awesome. And to a fault, I would definitely admit, like to a fault, if the thing does not reach that level, I'm like, bleh, gone.
Yeah. Yeah. There's something in there which is very much, and I know that this, you know, the company gets for all the right and some of the wrong reasons, like a really bad rap. I think that people that have had a good time at Facebook or have had a successful time at Facebook, this type of approach has rubbed off on them. It's core to like how they work now. The flip side of this that I also want to kind of indicate, which is why I said, I think that people should like kind of start at more established companies versus startups, is I did my first 5 years like running my own agency, and the mistakes that we made, I probably would have learned about like in 3 months at a company like Facebook. Yeah. Right now,
yeah.
The issue is, you know, luckily we weren't big and there wasn't a lot of money flowing around and we were not in the US and we didn't have any psychopath founders, myself being one of them. But like, if you have a environment in which your leaders or leader hasn't learned this yet, it actually has such a net negative effect on you, because best you grind away, you get some hard skills, you have a terrible time at best. At worst, you learn all these bad habits that you have to unlearn, and it actually slows you down in your career. And the core of what we're talking about is still, like, you know, running after the shiny thing, or, you know, there's like a ton of founders and like folks that really want to get the press, that want to get the FASCO article, that want to be in the Forbes 30 on their 30, all this kind of stuff. And the thing is, that's the least important part of all of this. I don't know how many listeners like know or don't know this. You have to nominate yourself for the Forbes 30 under 30, or someone has to nominate you. That's the thing with awards, like award-winning, blah, blah, blah.
I'm so glad I'm over 30, guys.
No, but like the 40 under 40 and whatever. And so a lot of the time, PR agencies are the ones that kind of like put you in there, and it's part of a bigger plan. A lot of the time when someone shows up on one of these lists, it's actually related to a larger plan around like something that they may be launching, or like, you know, 40 under 40 is like people deeper in their careers, etc. So like the award landscape is a little rickety, basically. But I think that if you don't, like, this is all bias, right? Like, I love focusing on the impact as much as Ryan just explained. I love focusing on the core of creating things for people, you know, as much as that. On the opposite end, though, the marketing of this all is very important. And yeah, also a blind spot for a lot of us who love to focus on the efficacy of the product and that impact.
Yeah. I mean, this gets like maybe segues into the public versus behind closed doors narrative of startups. I remember I was talking to a founder who sold this company, and they sold it a weird time because it felt like they were blowing up. Like everyone was using their tool. Everyone was tweeting about it. Just felt like they were on top of the world. Then they sold their company. And I remember asking the founder, I'm like, why did you sell? It seemed like everything was going great. And he kind of gave me this funny look. He goes, yeah, it seemed like that, huh? And it's just clear that what we experience or understand about a startup's success on Twitter is just not reality. It's all marketing. And I've even had this with Campsite, right? Like, I think people come to me all the time. They're like, seems like Campsite is just crushing it. I'm like, what makes you think that? They're like, well, I get your like change logs and stuff. And yeah, we're shipping stuff, but like people just read into tweets and like these hypey ship moments and like we launched a new thing. I don't know. People squint and see, oh, this startup is successful. So, I don't know. I think a little bit of just being on the inside now, you kind of train yourself to see, like, oh, that's what that tweet means. Or even to your point, Michael, like recognizing that, like, oh, that's part of a PR strategy. Oh, I bet they're about to fundraise. Like you start to notice these kinds of patterns in the tweets.
My favorite one on this, and I learned this quickly after I started investing, is all the acquisition messaging. And it's like, that's an acquihire.
Yeah.
Yes, sure, let's be excited about it. But can we also be real about it? You know, because a lot of the, oh my God, we got acquired kind of stuff is maybe your investors got their money back and the acquiring company gets a good team. You know, I mean, we talked about this in the context of Spectrum and GitHub, basically, where, yeah, at the end of the day, that was like a one-to-one for investors. And it, and in my opinion, I still stand behind that decision. You know, yeah, I got my money back, but I stand behind backing you all on that. At the core of that is acting as if things are much more than they are is partially something, sure, that's marketing. But on the other side, it's also really important to be realistic about this and be realistic about this publicly.
Yeah, I don't know, though. I think it's kind of par for the course. And I actually do believe that there's a reality distortion effect where like the more you can convince the world that you're the most important company on the planet, the more you start to build product in that way. I don't know. I think you can trick yourself into becoming important by telling everyone that you're important. It's this weird, I don't know, you call it fake it till you make it. But I think I can see how that happens or how that plays out, that you, the way you talk about yourself publicly, the way you talk about what's working and what's not working will bleed back into the momentum of the company and the emotional environment within the company for the rest of the team members. Like, we are also our own worst critics. I think like Ryan and I spend 99% of our time talking about like, what could be better? How could we be doing better? How could this feature be faster? How could this thing be smoother? How could we be talking to more customers? Like it is always, everything is always from the angle of something is not good and we want it to be better. And so I think when I encounter people in the real world who are like, Campsite seems to be doing really well, I actually think we could be better at acknowledging how far we've come and acknowledging some of the things we have done that are working really well. It's just not in my DNA, and I don't really think it's in Ryan's DNA to like linger on that. We just like quickly circle back to like, yeah, but there's 10 things that are broken that we're trying to fix. I've done a lot of founder therapy and startup therapy with just talking to other founders who have gone through the shit. And the thing that they tell me is, just you have to take these moments to reflect on how far you've come and like what you've learned, and that you are making a ton of progress, and that like wallowing in this zone of everything is broken and needs to be fixed is not good. I don't know a more elegant way to put that. You like, you got to come up for these moments of error and celebrate the wins. I think we're bad at this. Like we don't celebrate wins for very long. Like we ship the thing, onto the next, right? Like onto the next problem. Maybe that's even another cultural thing. It's like, how do you celebrate the wins so that you don't spend all of your time thinking about what's broken and what needs to be fixed?
I feel like Ryan has a lot of thoughts.
Yeah, I do. I mean, I completely agree. And I think that this comes from a place where like Ryan and I just have like a really high bar for like everything. We have a really high bar for products, the design, the craft of it, the performance of it. We have a high bar and high aspirations for what we want Campsite to be. We both talk about like one of our biggest fears is like middling success or like middling failure. We just don't want to do the kind of okay. We want this to be exciting and like fun and explosive. And so I think we're really hard on ourselves when something's not, we launch it and it's not 10xing users or engagement or something the next day. But a lot, I do think in the last year, a lot of what we've built, we're building on top of. Either we're reusing or has become like foundational to the product and we will continue to use. I mean, beginning of this year, a little bit of my own story, like I've barely written any React, never used Tailwind, never used Electron, never written like a single line of Ruby on Rails. And now I'm feeling like pretty okay at it. And that's awesome. I should pat myself on the back, but yeah, I'll definitely also be like, God, I wrote another shitty bug in Rails, like blew up our database again. But I mean, the beginning of this year, it took me like a week to write like a single controller action. I do think like our speed is like one of our strengths. And it gives me immense confidence to keep going because I'm like, we have the machinery to make something work. And I've fully convinced myself that this will take like 24 months to hit. And I'm like, yeah, that means we have at least another year of like figuring things out and building stuff. But I'm like, when we kind of like look at our runway and compare, we're like, oh my God, like, can you imagine how much stuff we could get done in that time? It's been 12 months. Like 12 months is, I actually have not even worked at Campsite for 12 months. I started at the beginning of January.
11 months in, yeah.
Yeah. And I feel like I've done so much shit in those 11 months that I'm like, another 11 months from now, 12 months from now, I'm like, we could write 10 more campsites in that amount of time.
Let's do it. Let's start over 10 times. Yeah.
But thinking about like physics or something, like it's like potential energy. I'm like a high amount of potential energy, which is very motivating. I mean, I'm a very like impact motivated person. And so if we ship something, we don't get the 10X, like it's, you know, I'll have a pity party for a day or something. But then I just remember like, yeah, but we built that feature in like 4 days. So yeah. Let's just do it again.
Yeah. Okay. So talk me through how you think about this, because startup advice, startup writing is all conflicting. Like you can literally go and find any article that says you should move fast and ship daily and look for the big win and it'll be obvious. And then there's other advice that's like, actually, it's the slow and steady compounding of these daily bits of progress that add up to something in multiple years, and most people just don't have the patience to get there. And that is one thing that I think about with what we're doing is quite often we'll ship things and it's not...
Those are not mutually exclusive, by the way.
It's not mutually exclusive, but I think what it gets at is like, how patient are you willing to be with a thing before you decide to cut it? We have features that a handful of people use. And I don't know, maybe that compounds over the next few years, but you got to maintain it. You got to figure out where it fits into the whole infrastructure of stuff. Anyways, I guess what I'm getting at is like, it seems that there's a danger of killing things too early because it didn't have like day one impact.
Yeah.
One of the things that I optimize for, which I don't think I've ever said publicly, and I don't think that might even some of my colleagues...
Exclusive.
This is an exclusive. TMZ. Is if I have to do the calculus on something, I will always optimize or give a way higher score to option value. The way that Shoebox is built, the way that this podcast is built, the way that I've done a lot of work internally at all these past jobs is like, when you build something and it doesn't have any opportunity cost, that's totally fine. Your whole job is build it fast. And as long as like everything that you build, you can build on top of, or you built it in a way that you actually execute against the downstream thing. And then you realize that middle stuff that you built wasn't really good enough. And you just refactor the middle stuff and make it more robust. Build in that way. And you can always like in a very composable way, make every part of the stack better, basically. And a lot of what I've seen is people painting themselves in the corners. And I think if you paint yourself into a corner, then you have to make a hard decision of either that is a full tech debt job, or maybe it's a product corner,
that you then have to decide, oh, well, this is a local optimum. And now we have to completely come up with something new that will both serve the need of this thing, but also have enough space to go beyond that. I think that's the scary one. Like when you have a feature that only a few people use and it's a secondary or tertiary feature, just let it live, you know, for let it live until it becomes this thing that has upkeep and will cost you things. It's the same to me, the same way as a lot of people are trying to always build the thing the right way the first time around. Whereas I always go back to the Steve Jobs iPhone demo where it's like, that was a piece of shit prototype. We now know that was a horrific prototype that could have crashed at any moment if he would have not done the happy path throughout that product. Knowing that should tell you that, hey, if the first like five users of something, there's all these engineers that like they want to build a nice thing, right? And I say this in a very generalist way. I mean this with like a high amount of respect because they can and it's a very important thing. When you have one customer requesting something for you, we're like in a SaaS context now, hack it together. When you have the second customer asking for you, give them access. And when the 10th customer or the 5th customer comes, decide a number in your business, then go and make a project out of it to make it a scalable thing. By making it like in the quote unquote correct way, you also incur so much backend stuff. You incur a bunch of perf stuff that if you would have just decided to put a JSON, say this is about like getting some kind of a fixed list out of something that you need to show on a page, just put a JSON file in there somewhere. It's fine for now, you know? And I think that's also maybe a little bit of that early Instagram, early Facebook mentality. Unless you know that this thing is going to work, don't invest too much time in it, which is why I said these things are not mutually exclusive to you just now, Brian, where if you tell me that you built something in 4 days, and it doesn't hit, or like you do demos with the with your customers and like in the next 2 weeks you find out, this is not the right way. Okay, pull it out for now. Because like it hasn't been shown to a lot of people. But if you've invested in a thing that you kind of 80% were like, oh, this is going to eventually do a thing and we built it in the right way and we can build these other things on top of it. Yeah, just let that thing sit around.
The other thing I'll add to this is, because I think it can matter what market you're in, what business you're in. If I was in like a B2C social networky sort of thing, the compounding effect probably is not a thing. You need virality, you need explosive growth, you need network effects. Like those are the things that you're like targeting. And that market, I think, favors trying a whole bunch of stuff. In our world, I do believe in the whole compounding effect. That's why I do have to like hold myself back when I want to cut things, because I think that you're right, Michael, that if something is not like an ongoing cost or an ongoing debt, like just let it linger, because who knows? You know, you might let a feature lie for a little while and then 6 months later, something pops off and somebody uses it in a novel way that you like have to learn from. And that leads me to the other part of this that's like, it's not only the compounding effect of the technology that you build, the product that you build, those sort of things. It's also the compounding effect of the things that you learn. And so if you're shipping something every single week, every other day, like the important part to me is that like we learn something from what we shipped. Basically putting like trying to be a little bit of a product scientist, that like we have this idea. We have a hypothesis that if we do this thing, it's going to have this effect. So then we'll build the thing as scrappy and fast as possible. We'll put it out. Did it have remotely the effect that we were expecting? Yes. Great. Maybe we need to go further. No. Why? And then you like learn from that thing and you like carry that forward in.
And write it down and put it in a place where people are going to find it later.
Yeah, oops.
I was, what's really fun. It's funny that you gave the answer to it.
No, we do that. This is what we do. We post a lot on Campsite.
Yeah, we write a lot.
We run Campsite on Campsite. And I think one of the cool things is that we have this place where you can write things and they show up in a feed for other people on your team to read them at a time of their choosing.
Yeah.
And that gives us space to write about what's working, what we want to try next,
yep.
Share data, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. Have you ever thought about just screencasting like 30 minutes of your day and how you use Campsite on Campsite?
I have thought about that and it feels so silly. It feels like, look at me.
Yeah, it You remember like the 15-minute Ruby on Rails tutorial that DHH did in like 2005 or 6 no, or whatever that was? That.
No.
It was like Rails 1.0, God knows what it was. There was a 15-minute tutorial about how to build a blog. How to build a blog in 15 minutes with Rails, basically. And it was, I mean, you know, DHH isn't known to be like not a self-important person. So it kind of fits the mold. But it was basically just like a very naive demo. You know, it was like a perfect golden path. Here's like how you do this. Here's how you use the scaffold function. Here's how you do this and this. And boom, like you have a blog, you know, and it's unstyled and all this kind of stuff. But it was like in a time where every stack was just like Linux, like Apache, MySQL, PHP. And it was a pain in the ass to do things. And here's a demo of doing this in 15 minutes. To me, the analog is everybody currently lives in this, like the 2014 narrative was like email sucks, inbox zero, blah, blah, blah. Email is dead. All hail Slack. We were in a workplace world, which was quite fantastic. And now the status quo is everyone lives in a fire hose world, high anxiety, hard to find things in Slack. If you show something that is like 10x different, better, whatever it is, I think that people will attract to that. I think that there is a big question or need that people like probably can't speak out loud because, you know, a lot of us are like learned helplessness. We're all like kind of used to the environments that we're in, that if you show us something different that is notably better, I'm fairly sure like people would attract to it. Not saying that I'm your VP of marketing, just saying that, you know.
I think maybe. So too. I'm not sure if that's a live stream or if it's some spicy blog post or something. But I mean, fundamentally, we agree. I think the Slack has been pretty unsatisfying for us to use internally. And one of the things that we've managed to do over the last few weeks is pretty much migrate all of our Slack usage over to Campsite. And so we're running all of our team communications on Campsite. And I think there's an opportunity. I think the time is right. I think people are overwhelmed. There might be this moment where we've reached peak channel and channels are not the pinnacle of team collaboration and team information organization. I think there's an appetite for something new.
Yeah, I don't think it's peak channel specifically, because I think we hit peak channel probably in like 2017, 16 already. I think it is that
Slack Connect moved us further into peak channel, but yeah.
Yeah, that's a good point. But the thing that I see is there is a lot of folks that started their career that are now more experienced, close to being in leadership positions over the last 7-ish years, that Slack is their default. It's never been different. And when you're young and you are early in your career, you just accept that and you just kind of deal with all the crap there. At a certain point, you get to have a critical thought about this. And I think that a lot of people who are traumatized, using that word very specifically, by the usage of a fire hose like Slack, probably are looking for something different. Those people will eventually start companies or take leadership roles in companies. We're also coming post like some economic bump. I think that we're going to see a lot of looking for something different. Now, the true thing that I think Slack wins on is integrations. It's not their actual core product. The fact that it integrates with everything is like the number one reason why some IT manager will not, like the other part won't win because it doesn't have that many integrations. That's generally the thing. But I do think that there is an appetite. And if you would start putting out there how we run Campsite on Campsite, you know, here's an example of how we run a project. Here's an example of how we talk about general stuff. Here's an example about an all hands or something. I think that would work pretty well. Anyway, hey, listeners. We actually started with the question, you know, what were some of your biggest lessons of this year so far? I think we've kind of, you know, we've hit a couple of topics really well. One of the original doors that we put out there that we haven't talked about is remote work. And it kind of dovetails into how to run Campsite on Campsite and Slack and all this. You know, both of you have worked in person at the space like Facebook. You've both worked remotely for various different companies as well as in person. I know you, Brian, were in person at GitHub for a while and then eventually remote. What has been your experience, like positives about remote, negatives about remote? How have you led your team in a remote world? Like, how do you think about scaling your team over time, et cetera?
I have such conflicting thoughts on remote. I think some days I'm like, I wish we were in person so bad. And then other days I'm so thankful that we have the opportunity to have this flexibility and people can live where they want to live and live life on their own terms. I think my perspective on it is I'm glad we're remote because it means Ryan and I get to work together. I live in SF and Ryan's in New York. It would have been hard for us to figure out a way where like we both end up in the same city or even nearby to each other, just with the timing of everything and kids and families and all this kind of stuff. I still think it probably would have been better if we were in person in the early stages. We try and make it a point to, we do meetups. We've done two team offsites, and then I've been to New York a couple of extra times just to get FaceTime with Ryan. But my hunch is that startups who are in person early on are probably going to move a little bit faster and get to correct answers sooner. I don't know. This is why I have conflicting feelings and probably not an interesting insight on remote work, is that I think half the time it's great, half the time it sucks. And for the stage of the company you work at, it matters a lot, and probably your role within that company. I think from like a founder, early stage startup, I kind of wish we'd been in person. The bright side of us being remote is it's helped us build Campsite in a much more intentional way, where we need it to work well for Ryan and I being online at different times and the rest of our team having this async access, right? It's like it helps inform the tool that ideally will be used by other people who are also remote or hybrid. Because I think remote or at least hybrid is probably the future for most teams. It's put us in a better position to empathize with the people who are using our tool. But man, on the day-to-day, like building the thing level, I think you move faster in person.
Yeah, I'll echo a lot of that. Brian, I've talked about it before too, that like I would so much rather work with Brian remotely than at like another company in person. Also, speaking for myself, I don't ever want to be full-time in person again, just from a personal life, hobbies, family, interests, routine sort of thing. I'm like, no, I love being able to go on a run in the early or like mid morning. I love being able to go pick up my kid from daycare, put him to sleep, and then get back to work. I don't want to have to commute and like do all that stuff just to be able to like fit these things in. You know, working at like at Facebook here in New York was like kind of nice because we had a shower, we didn't have a gym, we were next to a gym. Like those amenities are nice, but like those opportunities are also super rare. And at our size and stage, like of course we're not going to do any of that stuff. If I could wave a magic wand, yes, I would love for like Brian and I, my perfect situation would be Brian is like lives on my floor and we can like work on our own time.
Maybe a different floor. Maybe a different floor.
Yeah, maybe like one or two below.
I would be above. I'd be above for sure.
Oh yeah, of course. You're the CEO. Yeah.
Better view, just slightly better view.
Yeah. But that, yeah, when we do our stuff in person, it's awesome. It's awesome. I think probably the biggest drawback, being at an early stage startup, being co-founders, is like when there's ideas or problems or we're trying to figure out priorities and stuff, it's too easy to just like go back into deep work and like work on something and not merge your brains together, swim in the ideas in the mess and like come up with either like something new or like figure something out. I mean, basically, like, it's easy to procrastinate with like their work versus like figuring out what's this one big problem that's in front of us. And I think that that can be challenging sometimes. And I think what I have to do, what I think Brian and I do a decent job at, is like we just got to like fix it right then. Hey, here's this like customer needs this thing, or this thing's broken, or we just got this really bad feedback, or we need to align on these two projects are conflicting. Like kind of just like you can't wait. And it's easy in a remote world to just like not address things because it's like, they're in a different time zone. I'm going to go to the gym. I'm going to have lunch, you know, whatever, we get in the way, versus like you were sharing desks. It's like, hey, we got to fix this problem. Boom. Great. Then you just like solve it. Not to mention the kind of like passive idea sharing and stuff. But yeah, that said, I don't ever want to like have to 40, 50, 60 hours a week, butts in seats with coworkers. And then the talent aspect, I want to be able to hire like awesome people, and I don't want to be confined to a location. I just want to be able to find.
I mean, I think that actually is maybe the strongest point here is the other two people on our team, Nick and Josh, they're based in San Diego and Boston. Like, don't think we would have had the opportunity to work with them if we had this, got to be in New York, got to be in San Francisco. I just don't think, I don't know that there's that much appetite anymore to move cities to take a job at a startup. Like, there was an appetite for that in maybe the mid-2000s or going into the early teens.
This also has to do with like life stages. And
yeah,
there's a lot of people that still want to be close to the fire and work really hard on these things, but also have to balance it with like other priorities in life, which obviously makes a ton of sense. One thing I started kind of noodling on while you were talking was, we come from an era of, you know, 40% headcount growth for 10 years straight or something. The team at Campsite is about 4 people now. Because you're remote, do you think about if you were to grow, say you were to add, you want to go to the next stage, right? Like, are you optimizing for less but better people because of the communication streams? Like, how do you kind of think about that?
Yeah, I don't think of moving to the next stage as like any sort of headcount. Like, I don't correlate headcount with business success. I think that used to be a thing. I mean, I don't know. I guess you can ballpark it. Like, okay, if you have 1,000 employees, like I can kind of guess the size of your business and like the stage that you're at. But my hunch is that the future is full of companies that are going to be a lot smaller than we're used to, having a lot more impact than you would expect. And so, yeah, I'm all aboard the less but better. Let's have a team of really good people and grow very slowly, because I don't know, we get a lot done with 4 people. And as we all know, like adding more people doesn't, like each incremental person doesn't make you move that same incremental bit faster. It's always, there's a communication overhead that means each incremental person you get actually less output from them. So you got to be careful there. But I'm on board the fewer.
I want to dig into this a little more.
People. Yeah.
I want to dig into this a little more because it reminded me, there was this question that Zuck used to ask all the time, which is, how can you get this done in half the time? And the other question is, what would you be able to do if you had twice the amount of people? I would love to hear your answer. Like, how would you be able to build Campsite faster in half the time? And what would you be able to do with twice as many people?
I mean, twice as many people, I think, is the easier one for me, just because we'd like mobile app. There's like several bigger features that require specialty experience, expertise that we would love to build, that we could build with our current team, but none of us are experts in it. So it would just like take us longer and we would have to deprioritize something else. So there's like definitely core stuff that I think that we would do with more people. In fact, like I think we've had this conversation several times where like we technically could hire more people if we wanted to stretch ourselves. But I think that we feel pretty confident that we have the right team, the right makeup to figure out like what the next stage of Campsite's going to look like. And it's like, I'd rather just like, let's figure that out and feel really excited and confident about it. And then like, figure out whatever the next stage is. As far as moving, well, I want to hear what you have to say, Brian, about before I talk about moving or doing things at like half the time.
Yeah, I think it's just one thing for Zuck to say it at like literally this one in a gajillion company that grew in the way that they grew. So we're just super early stage and we don't have, you know, very clear product market fit. We're figuring that out. And so actually like doubling the team right now would be a pretty big mistake. Even if we doubled the team and like built a mobile app, like I still think it would be a mistake right now, because all of a sudden every single thing that you do, you got to figure out how it works on mobile. Every time you want to unship something, you got to unship it twice. I think like it would make us move half as fast, actually. But at a certain point, when we're confident in the thing that we've built and we've found traction in the marketplace, then yeah, we should definitely double the team and build those things, because that's what our customers will expect.
What about non-tech people?
What about non-tech people? What do you mean?
Well, I've heard you talk about engineers and maybe designers.
Marketing, sales.
Oh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it's one of those things where it's like, I would love to have somebody that does all of that, but I think there's a lot of value in the early team, like kind of feeling the pain of having to do the marketing and telling the story and answering the support tickets. Yes, we will fill in those gaps eventually with other people, but I think there's just so much value in everyone right now being really close to the problem, close to the user, and being able to respond to that basically instantly. Quite often, you know, we're able to fix bugs within a few minutes of somebody reporting it. And I think as soon as you start to spread that around, prematurely spread it around, we will have those roles eventually, right? I could imagine a world where like we get help on some of the marketing and ops stuff, but I've read enough articles that say this is a mistake. It's a trap that a lot of startup founders fall into where they think, oh, I'm just going to hire a COO and they're going to do hand wave operations without really understanding what that means or like how they're going to be effective at it. So yes, it means that right now, like we do those things. We write the change logs and the blog posts and the tweets and do this stuff that maybe doesn't feel like the highest impact minute of work to output of value type tasks. But I think what it's going to do is it, I don't know, helps us understand what we want to actually hire for really clearly when we do get to that point. I don't know. We're just so small and so early that I feel like a lot of the questions around hiring and optimizing and like specializing roles and stuff is just not relevant yet until we figure out the product.
Yeah, I really believe that like I would rather hire when we're kind of like feeling the pain and we know precisely the role, the person, the expertise, everything that we need to hire for, rather than just like, you know, oh, we raised all this money and we like have headcount and we can just like fill seats. Because then you do have to manage those people. You have to give them important things to work on. You have to know what they're going to work on. And there's always risk. There's always risk that like they're not going to work out or they're going to want to do things differently. And then you got to manage that. So yeah, I would so much rather be at the point where we're like, oh my God, something's working. We know precisely who we're selling this product to. We need a salesperson that we can say, here's the customer profile. Here's some early leads. Or yes, we have these big customers that will sign up if we had a mobile app. So we need a mobile person because they're going to build exactly this and we know what the product is. Rather than like, okay, let's great. You've got mobile expertise. So you're going to build an app. And guess what? It's going to change every 5 days. And you're going to have to like rebuild all these new features. And it's just going to, it would totally slow us down. And that's just from like product standpoint, let alone the like people, company management, all of that stuff.
Just going back to the original amount of doors that we opened, there kind of is like one door left, which is the door of grit that we haven't really dug into. I mean, we've kind of tangentially dug into it, but one of the bigger questions that I actually have right now, Brian, you're a year plus in. Ryan, you've been a part of this ride for most of that time. What are some of the surprises or lessons that you learned that you may not be as good at, or like things that you're excited about solving in the next year ahead? And I don't want features.
One of the things that Ryan and I talk about a lot is we had this really positive experience at Facebook using Workplace internally, where Workplace was this conduit to get ideas in front of lots of people and lots of people who weren't directly in your sphere of influence. I don't know. I wasn't at Facebook that long. And I was also like not an important person there, but I was able to look around and see people have these moments where an idea posted to Workplace actually changed the way the company worked or changed what they wanted to build. Like it was truly this medium for conversation where some engineer or some designer could post a thing and like Zuck would respond, jump in, right? And everybody else could follow along with those conversations and watch leadership engage with you. I don't know, it's just like this really cool spectator, but you're also in it type of working, way of working. I want to figure out how more teams can experience that. You talk to a lot of teams now who feel the same anxieties, the same overwhelming drowning in the fire hose of information, disconnected from leaders, especially if they're working in a remote world, feeling disconnected from people in general. I think there's a lot of that happening in the world right now for most people on most teams. And I don't know that tools solve all problems, but I think that there's an opportunity for a tool to solve a lot of these problems of helping people feel more engaged at work, like their voices matter, like their ideas are important and can actually change the trajectory of a team or a business. And I want to figure that out, right? Like, we talk to a lot of designers and design managers who don't know what people are working on. Like, they are so isolated. One of the funny things is we talk to so many people who they just really want the experience of having a foam core board on the wall with printed out pictures of UI. They're like, I just want that. I want to have this sensation that I'm surrounded by people doing interesting work. And so they come to a tool like Campsite and they just want to feel connection to people and work and interesting ideas. And I think we can solve that in a pretty meaningful way. I don't think we've quite cracked it, but this idea of showing up to the tool where you communicate with your team and feeling connected, feeling surrounded by inspiring ideas, feeling surrounded by inspiring work is a positive thing for people who spend, you know, a third of their life or more working on something. I think that a third of your life should feel really great and feel like you're growing and learning. And tools can help. So that's what I want to figure out. I don't know, it's a little bit aspirational, hand wavy, but that's the stuff that we think about internally.
I like it. Ryan?
I think something I'm most surprised about, or both surprised at and find challenging, is balancing what somebody says they want. In fact, what somebody is willing to pay for or says that they will pay for and actually does pay for, and what they actually want. And then also balancing with your own taste and ideas and interests. And the Venn diagram of nailing that little cross section, I just find like hitting that really hard. I think I came into Campsite expecting that, like, somebody says, like, here, I'm going to give you a check for a thing. That's like what they want. You know, I think a lot of the like startup reading is that, like, oh, people will tell you ideas, people will tell you they'll use their thing, but like putting up money is like hard part. And when you got somebody that's actually going to put up money, there you go. But I don't think that's the end of the story. Especially big companies have cash. They can spend money on tools. They can buy products, subscriptions, like whatever. Even in a little bit of a market downturn, it doesn't necessarily mean, I think it really matters, like, who's paying. Is this like a personal thing? Or is this like a team's, you know, a couple thousand dollars out of a team's budget? It can be really hard to figure out what the actual problem is and like what somebody wants to pay for. It won't be as simple as, like, what actually really sparked the idea, Brian, when you mentioned like the want to be able to like walk in and see like an artboard of stuff. You know, we'll have like literally somebody will be like, I want that artboard. You may build the artboard and then they look at it and they're like, great, I love it. And then they never come back to the app. It's like digging into like, what did the artboard do?
Yeah.
And what was the value it provided for them, for the team? And like, how do you capture that? And I say that I like am surprised by it. I'm challenged by it. I also like, I'm so motivated to like find that and to like get good at that. You know, it gets back to kind of what I was saying at the beginning. Like, I really just want to build something that like somebody just freaking loves, that they just use every day. I mean, like the way that we use Campsite, yes, we're not on like exponential growth curve, but man, I freaking love using what we've built like every single day. A lot of the work that we've been doing recently is like better mobile support and everything. Like, I have the website of our app saved to my own home screen and I'm like opening and checking stuff and engaging and stuff because like that's how we work and that's how we communicate. And it just feels like really great. And I want to provide that moment to others.
Awesome. That sounds great.
Thanks for having us, Michael.
Thanks a lot for coming on the show. Really appreciate hearing all of this. And I definitely like love hearing kind of these challenges and like these aspirations. They resonate with me a lot. Obviously, very biased ex-Facebook, ex-Instagram person. But really appreciate your candor and your honesty and this different angle and different type of tone to how hard it is to do this type of stuff and how much thought goes into so many details, both product-wise and building the business, et cetera. So really, really grateful. Thank you so much.
Have Never a trust day. A startup founder that says they're crushing it.
You know,
there's always shit.
I will say though, because I've had so many like of my ex Instagram friends, either that still work there or work at other companies, like ask if I would ever go back to big tech. And I'm like, I'm sorry, absolutely not. Like I feel like the amount of learning that we get to do, the amount of product and people learning and like running the business, like all the stuff that we're doing is just like completely new to me. And then the technology is changing and evolving. Customers and users are changing and evolving. Like the pace of learning is more than I've ever seen. So yeah, I wouldn't be doing anything different. Like in spite of all the like hardship, it's not cushy, but like that's the point.
Awesome. Take care, y'all.
Thanks, Michael.
Thanks, guys. See ya.
Thanks again for listening. If you aren't a subscriber yet, you should totally check out some of the other episodes. So hit that subscribe button. And if you're looking for some of the top episodes, go to fullstackwhatever.com.